Les colloques du Collège de France.
James is now going to give us a keynote on the evolution of mammalian X chromosome dosage compensation. So thank you so much, James, for joining. We would have loved to have you here with us, but it's great that you could come in online. Over to you.
Thanks, Edith. And thanks for organising this meeting. It's such a shame I can't be with you. I'm actually in Edinburgh at the moment at an unconventional model organisms meeting, which is brilliant. And actually, it's germane to today's discussion, because I will be talking to you about unusual model organisms and, as Edith mentioned, marsupials. So I'm just going to start by reminding an audience that knows and loves this system very well about the paradigm of mammalian X inactivation as we've known it for many years. And of course, as we know from work from a number of groups in a number of species, X chromosome inactivation in the so-called eutherian mammals, including humans and mice and rabbits, is regulated by this long non-coding RNA EXIST, which is expressed from one of the two X chromosomes and brings in chromatin modifiers and eventually silences the chromosome. Now, when we talk about X inactivation, in most eutherians, we think of it as so-called random, meaning that it has a roughly equal probability of affecting the paternal or the maternal X chromosome. Okay, so what about marsupials? So marsupials, there are around about 300 species, most of them of which are indigenous to Australasia. And they diverged from eutherians about 160 million years ago, so actually a considerable amount of time in terms of amnio evolution. And what's intriguing about marsupials, and this was actually known for many decades ago from work from Des Cooper, is that female marsupials, just like eutherian females, undergo X inactivation. They form a heterochromatic body, a bar body. And yet we know actually that marsupials don't have the EXIST long non-coding RNA. And the other interesting idiosyncrasy of marsupial X inactivation is that rather than X inactivation being random, actually X inactivation is imprinted. So it always affects one particular X chromosome, and that turns out to be the X chromosome from the father. And that is the case actually in all of the tissues. So as you'll know, imprinted X inactivation takes place in very early mouse development, and then of course in the epiblast derivative switches to random. But in the case of marsupials, it's imprinted in all the tissues that have been studied so far. Okay, so a couple of questions that have now occupied my lab's research program for around about 15 years now, I would say, is firstly, how do marsupials X inactivate if they don't have this this long non-coding RNA EXIST? And secondly, how do marsupials ensure that X chromosome inactivation is imprinted? How is this choice made at the epigenetic level to silence one of those, one particular chromosome? And so the work that I'm going to describe today has been carried out by a lot of people over a long period of time, and I'm not going to name all of them because you can see their names. They're a wonderful bunch of complementary and fantastic scientists. But I am going to pick out a couple of members that should be in the audience with you, and that if you haven't interacted with, please do. One of them is Aurelien, and I'll present his data today on genome editing of RSX, and Valdoni, who is our senior technician, who's really kept all of the labs, all the projects in the lab running very smoothly. So the model that we've used for this is the opossum, which is actually a South American marsupial. We love it, of course, because it's very cute, first and foremost. But actually, the reason why I think this is a great model system is because it's, you know, really constantly surprised us and actually taught us that epigenetics can be carried out in a number of different ways using a number of different elaborate processes. And I'm going to show you a couple of those examples today. Okay, so we know actually, well, we think that X chromosome inactivation in marsupials is carried out by a fundamentally different non-coding RNA, which many of you will know. This is RSX, which I'll present in a subsequent slide. But I want to spend just a couple of minutes talking about the history of the discovery of RSX, because as you know, EXIST, when you perform RNA fish, will form this really lovely cloud of RNA that will coat the inactive X chromosome in cis, as shown for a mouse female cell on the left-hand side of the slide. But when we started getting better information on the genome of marsupials, and particularly the opossum, actually, a number of groups, including Phil Avner's, Surin Zakayan, Jenny Graves, and Jeannie Lee's lab, actually looked at the syntenic region of the marsupial chromosome where EXIST sits, and found that there's a protein coding gene, which is actually protein coding in all amniotes that have been studied so far, called NNX3, which is actually expressed in both sexes and was unlikely, therefore, to have had a role in X chromosome activation, at least the early stages. So that was quite mysterious. And then some years later, we, by total serendipity, came across another long non-coding RNA originating or located at a completely different part of the therion X chromosome, from which this RNA RSX for RNA on the silent X chromosome was encoded. Now, RSX and EXIS show no primary sequence homology, and I'm always careful when I say that because, you know, how do you define sequence homology? It kind of depends how you set your parameters. But we think actually, based on the low level of primary sequence homology, that this RNA evolved completely independently. And I'm happy to explain to anyone that's interested how I think these two non-coding RNAs came about during mammalian evolution. But what's fascinating about RSX is that despite the fact that it has no primary sequence homology, it shows properties that are very, very similar to EXIS. And there are many of those. But the one that I'm showing here on this slide is that it forms a cloud that's it's an RNA that's expressed only from the inactive X and only in females, and that enshrouds the X chromosome in cis. Okay, so the question, of course, is RSX required for marsupial X inactivation? And the original publication, we described some data where we took an RSX transgene and placed it onto a mouse chromosome and showed that it could induce some degree of silencing in cis. But of course, the really important experiment, of course, is to knock the thing out. And if you knock the thing out and you don't get X inactivation, then of course, that's much more compelling. So in order to obviously to understand how X inactivation or to delete RSX, we need to know during development when RSX is actually expressed. And so some years ago, we carried out a study in which we analyzed the ontogeny of X inactivation in a marsupial. And the data for that is shown here. So in essence, what we did was to perform RNA FISH and single cell sequencing for RSX and to look at X inactivation in the opossum early embryo. Now, I'll show you later in the presentation the whole sort of timeline of opossum embryogenesis, but I want to just focus on a piece of data that was particularly critical for our RSX targeting experiments, where we found actually that even at the very early in development, at the 8 to 16 cell stage, which is shown here in the left-hand side by this schematic, the 8 to 16 cell stage embryo actually in marsupials is very different to eutherians because they have no inner cell mass. But in essence, what we found is that as soon as the embryonic genome switches on around about the 8-cell stage, that we were already seeing not only expression of RSX from the paternal X chromosome, but actually coating of that paternal X chromosome and silencing. And so what you're looking at here is essentially a flattened, approximately 16-cell stage embryo, where we performed RNA FISH for RSX and a gene that we love to study, which is an assay of X chromosome inactivation, an X-linked gene called MSN. And what I hope you can appreciate is that all of these blastomeres have clouds of RSX. And when you magnify these, you can see that we have a coated paternal X chromosome and strictly monoallelic expression of this X-encoded gene MSN. So what this told us then was that in order to obviously delete RSX, we would have to go in earlier than embryonic genome activation. And actually, we decided to do this at the zygote stage. And so at that point, we embarked on an almost, well, almost just over a decade-long process of developing genome editing in marsupials. And actually, we were really grateful several years ago to be able to see a publication from the lab of Hiroshi Kiyonari at Kobe Ricken, where Hiroshi actually demonstrated for the first time genome editing in opossums. He didn't target a non-coding RNA. He targeted the tyrosinase gene and generated these super cute white opossums that you should look at if you can find that publication. So we teamed up with Hiroshi and actually found that many of the technologies we were doing to perform genome editing were very similar. And I'm going to show you now a couple of the challenges that Aurelien and the team experienced when they started this work. Because, of course, the first thing you need to do is to be able to genome edit the opossum genome. And, of course, CRISPR is widely used across different species, and we didn't envisage that would be a problem, and it wasn't. But then, of course, you have the stage of zygote microinjection where you have to inject these things. Now, marsupial embryos are a bit different to eutherian embryos because not only do they have the zona pellucida, but they have two additional coats that are very thick, the mucoid coat and then a shell. And so we eventually settled on essentially using a piezo drill to be able to reach the pronuclei. And then when you've successfully injected your zygotes, you then have to develop two surgical techniques. Of course, you want to transplant these zygotes and then follow their development to see what happens to X inactivation. And so we had to develop uterine transfer in female opossums. And the slightly more tricky technology was to generate pseudo-pregnant females. And that required that we had to develop opossum vasectomies in males, which was an interesting and varied experience. But eventually, we managed to achieve that and ultimately develop the technologies we needed for phenotyping, for transplanting these embryos and then eventually phenotyping them. And then the other challenge, of course, is that unlike in Hiroshi's experiments, we weren't targeting a protein coding gene, so we couldn't rely on just using a single guide. And those of you that have tried to delete EXIST, for example, you know that to really remove this thing, you need to take out the whole promoter to completely extinguish expression. So we had the same challenge with RSX, where we decided to use a two-cut approach to completely remove the promoter. And we did this experiment in XX fibroblasts, opossum fibroblasts, and found that this could. We looked at a number of different guides and found a pair that eventually we discovered could completely extinguish RSX expression. Okay, so what did we see? Well, I'm showing you now a magnification of a control E5.5 female embryo where we've injected guides that actually don't target RSX. They target tyrosinase, so an irrelevant gene to the purpose of today's conversation. Essentially, this is the control. And again, what you can see here are clouds of RSX and then monoallelic expression of our marker gene MSN, and that is quantitated in the first column. So now I'm showing you data from three representative opossums where we've injected guides to RSX, and there are essentially two important take-home messages from this from these slides. And the first is that what we now see in our RSX deletion are the appearance of cells in which X chromosome inactivation, at least as assayed by MSN, has not taken place, and in which the RSX cloud is not evident or is barely evident. And that's shown in the images on the right-hand side. So here we have some clean RSX deletions where we can see now biallelic expression of MSN. And we also have actually, and we've talked about this a lot, and this intrigues us greatly, these other blastomeres where we can see very tiny clouds of RSX, but nevertheless, we still have a failure of X chromosome inactivation. Now, why we see these tiny clouds is not clear. It may well be that we've got a deletion and RSX levels are going down, and so the cloud is diminishing, or it could be that we've generated a hypomorphic mutation where levels are initiation levels are very low. But nevertheless, the phenotype is the same, that we get failure of X chromosome inactivation. And the second observation that I'm sure you all have noted is that all of these embryos are mosaics. So in all of them, we see some cells in which RSX is present and in which MSN is normally silenced. Now, this is great because it acts as a really nice internal control, but it raises the question that if we want to apply genome editing to other species, then of course we need to eliminate this issue of mosaicism, and we have a number of ways in which we're trying to do that now. So we have single-cell omics data. I mean, these edited embryos come through infrequently, and so they're very precious, but we've processed the data actually in the last couple of weeks, and we find, I think I'm reasonably confident to tell you that at the whole chromosome level, RSX is required for initiation, but interestingly, it's not required for the maintenance of X inactivation. And you know, I'm very careful to comment that something is not required for the maintenance of X inactivation, because of course it depends how hard you look. But what I think we can say at least at the sort of wholesale level of the X, looking at X autosome ratios and for most genes, that RSX is probably dispensable. Okay, so we think RSX then is important. We have a bit of a way to go, but we're wrapping up this manuscript now, and this will be submitted soon. But the fact now we know that RSX is likely the EXIST equivalent, this now makes the next question a bit easier to address, which is how do marsupials ensure imprinted X inactivation? Because of course, imprinted X inactivation in mice is centered on the EXIST locus. And so by equivalent, by analogy, if we want to understand how marsupial X inactivation is mediated, then we should probably be looking at the RSX locus. And I can tell you actually that we think the mechanism of imprinted X inactivation is DNA methylation. This, of course, is the classic, the first ever discovered epigenetic mark, and of course, regulates canonical imprinting in eutherians. So, what did we expect? Well, we now have a scenario, of course, in female somatic tissues from marsupials where we have RSX expressed only from the paternal X chromosome. So, we might expect that the paternal RSX promoter is unmethylated. and the maternal copy is not expressed, and therefore the maternal RSX copy would be expected to be methylated. Now, of course, daughters get their maternal X from their mum, from the oocyte, and the paternal X from the dad, from the sperm. And so by looking at the gametes and assaying DNA methylation, we wanted to investigate whether indeed there was a DMR, a differentially methylated region centered at the RSX promoter. And so to address this question, Bryony Leake, a PhD student in the lab, whose picture I showed earlier on, carried out what I think was a really heroic experiment, essentially carrying out bisulfite sequencing on opossum gametes and embryos, actually, for the first half of gestation, to really assay what's going on at the RSX promoter, but also, as I'll show you later, to get a more broad view of what's happening genome-wide for DNA methylation in the marsupial gamete and in the embryo. And what she found, actually, was that there is indeed a DMR. So if you scan the RSX region and look at this DNA methylation data, you can see that there's a level of very high methylation, which is present in the promoter exon 1 and intron 1 of the oocyte. And that region is fully unmethylated within the sperm. But finding a DMR, of course, doesn't tell you that it's instructive for X chromosome activation. And for it to be instructive, of course, it needs to be retained in the embryo. And we found that indeed it is. So if Bryony now looks at male embryos that, of course, inherit their X chromosome from the oocyte, that high level of methylation across the RSX region is retained. But in females that, of course, get one X chromosome from mom and one X chromosome from dad, and therefore where you'd expect to see on aggregate an intermediate level of methylation, that's indeed what she finds, levels around about 50%. So, of course, this doesn't tell us that that DNA methylation marker is instructive. And what we would want to do, of course, is to use epigenome editing based CRISPR technologies, which we're working on to specifically remove that methylation mark. We have done an experiment where we've wiped methylation from the whole genome, and we find that RSX is now expressed from the maternal X. But that's published, and so I won't go into that in the details of that experiment. But we do think, therefore, that the imprinted exon activation probably involves DNA methylation. And some of you who might remember our single cell sequencing paper from several years ago will wonder about another possible mechanism by which imprinted exon activation is achieved that we espoused in that paper, but I haven't mentioned, which is this antisense RNA to RSX called XSR, which we discovered, again, fortuitously. And what's intriguing about XSR is that rather in a similar manner to the TSIX exist paradigm, XSR is expressed only from the maternal X chromosome. Now, what is it doing? If we have the methylation that's imposed on the RSX promoter in the gamete, why do we need XSR? And maybe we don't need XSR, and unless we knock the thing out, we don't know. But what I'd like to suggest is that maybe what XSR is doing is what TSIX has been doing, is doing in the mouse, as shown by Takashi Sato. And maybe the ongoing expression of XSR from the maternal X chromosome might be maintaining that methylation across the RSX promoter as the embryo develops, and therefore ensuring that maternal RSX copy stays off. Okay, so I'm now going to move slightly away from sex chromosomes because, as I mentioned, we now have in our hands essentially DNA methylation landscapes for the entire opossum genome. And so we can start asking questions: to what extent does the epigenome and does epigenetic differences exist between different theory and mammals? And before I show you the marsupial data, what I want to do is to highlight for those of you who don't think about DNA methylation as much as we have in the last few years in embryos, that actually in eutherians, the DNA methylation landscape is highly dynamic, and there is this wave of DNA methylation loss that takes place within the pre-implantation embryo. So what I'm showing you here is a schematic that is really the assembly or a summary of work from a number of different labs whose names are shown at the bottom of the slide. But in essence, in eutherians and most well-studied in mice and in humans, the sperm is very highly methylated and the egg much less methylated. And then at fertilization, what first happens is that the paternal genome becomes rapidly demethylated by an active mechanism, I think the basis of which is still up for debate. And then as the embryo enters the cleavage stage, there's a phase of passive demethylation that gives rise to a blastocyst that has essentially the lowest level of methylation that you see in early embryogenesis, around about 20%. And then after implantation, the DNMTs impose, reinstate the somatic program of methylation, which is found in the embryo. And of course, all of you will know that also methylation appears on the inactive X chromosome, specifically in CpG islands. And that may or may not be important for the maintenance of X inactivation. And that's something that I'll come back to in the very last slide. But importantly, levels of methylation in the placenta are lower than they are in the derivatives of the epiblast. And I'd like you to remember this fact, because this will become relevant when I show you the marsupial data. So why do we do this? And my experience actually is that you'll get a different answer depending on whether you speak to a transposon biologist or a placental biologist or an epigeneticist. But essentially, there's a lot of ideas that people have grappled with, which are listed here. I mean, obviously, if your epigenomes of your sperm and egg are different, you need to equalize those. It may well be that wiping of methylation is important for pluripotency, that it's important for the formation of the placenta, and I'm really keen on this idea, and I'll show you why later, but also maybe to permit expression of transposons that we know regulate early expression, and maybe it's an opportunity to raise epi mutations. Now, the difficulty with looking at this in the Eutherian is that lots of very important things happen in a very kind of squeezed and temporally short phase of development, but in the marsupial, of course, things are very spread out, so this means that when we assay our DNA methylation dynamics, we can tether them to specific events within embryo development. And I'll just very briefly describe opossum embryo development. Like all marsupials, it's very short. They're born at E14.5 and they don't implant actually until 11.5. But what's rather paradoxical is that they don't even think, despite that short gestation, of making a blastocyst until around E5.5, so around a third of the way through gestation. And then shortly after that, they generate the primitive endoderm, shown here in green, and the epiblast in purple, and importantly, the trophectoderm, the placental precursor. So when we looked at our data, what we found is that the global loss of DNA methylation, as it's defined in Eutherians, does not occur in opossum embryos. And this, to us, was a huge surprise. And well, actually, I think it was a surprise to everyone, not just us. So to ensure that we were correct in our conclusions, what we wanted to first demonstrate to ourselves is that we can perform bisulfite sequencing and we can interpret our data correctly. And so we did a quick pilot experiment in mice where we assayed DNA methylation in sperm and in adults. And what you see here is essentially this classical bimodal distribution where most CpGs are highly methylated, but a low proportion, these are CpG islands, are unmethylated. But indeed, when we look at mouse blastocysts, we see that this is wiped. And the most CpGs are now unmethylated. In the opossum, things look very different. So now you're looking all the way, we have the sperm and the egg on the left-hand side, the cleavage stages from E1.5 to E4.5, and then the blastocyst shown here. And what I think you can appreciate is that this bimodal distribution that is typical of the sperm and somatic tissues in mice and in other eutherians is present in the sperm and the egg. And this bimodal distribution is actually largely retained through the cleavage divisions. And it's not until you reach the blastocyst where you begin to see that the very highly methylated moieties are now losing methylation. Now, things here get quite tricky because, of course, we're looking at bulk DNA methylation here, but the blastocyst is now beginning to segregate lineages, the primitive endoderm and the epiblast and the trophectoderm. And so we wondered actually whether or not what we were seeing here is actually reflective of maybe one of the lineages or more of the lineages, but actually is not reflected by all of the lineages of the blastocyst. And so we did actually what was probably a quick and dirty experiment where we first dissected the embryonic disc, which contains the epiblast from the trophectoderm, and performed bulk on both of those lineages, and found actually that DNA methylation is largely retained in the epiblast. There's a bit of a drop. I'll show you in the subsequent slide, but that the bulk of demethylation was likely occurring in the trophectoderm. So, of course, we wanted to confirm this using single cell analysis, and we did that essentially by disaggregating our blastocysts, diagnosing using transcriptomics what lineage they represented, and then performing methylomics. And we found actually that pre-divergence levels of methylation around about 55%. There is maybe a transient drop before recovery in the epiblast, and this actually correlates quite nicely with a dip and rise in expression of DNMT enzymes, the significance of which we're still investigating. But it is indeed the case that the loss of methylation or the persistent loss of methylation is observed in the trophectoderm. So this shows you now mean levels of methylation in the opossum, aggregating all the data I showed you in the previous slides. And I've got a few statements here for the the DNA methylation aficionados. Essentially, what we see here is that the oocyte within the opossum is much more methylated than the oocyte in eutherians, such that the levels of methylation in sperm and egg are very similar. There are differences. I'll mention a bit about those subsequently. But essentially, the levels stay stable. And then, of course, you make the blastocyst and levels of methylation go down, with demethylation being largely restricted to the trophectoderm. There are, of course, differentially methylated regions. We identified a number of those. But rather than being lost by this wiping, these DMRs are gradually lost by local reprogramming during the cleavage stages. But some persist. And we localize those DMRs to their nearest neighboring genes. And through that approach, we identified 78 putatively imprinted genes in the opossum, which, of course, we need to go on and confirm with RNA SNP-based analysis. So, rounding up, of course, the X chromosome is often the exception to the rule. And what I've told you, that DNA methylation is retained actually throughout the autosomes of the epiblast. The inactive X chromosome is the exception, and this was really surprising to us because what we noted, and we can do this with SNP analysis at the level of DNA, is that while the active X chromosome retains the bimodal distribution shown here that's typical of autosomes, the inactive X chromosome is fully hypomethylated. We weren't the first to show this. It was actually shown by Paul Walter's group and another paper looking at the koala DNA methylation landscape. But we showed actually this occurs beginning around about E4.5. And so this is quite mind-boggling to think that you're retaining DNA methylation on your autosomes, but the inactive X specifically is losing methylation. And this raises the question, how is X inactivation maintained without DNA methylation? I'm sure there are members of the audience that think that DNA methylation has perhaps important roles or maybe not so important roles in the maintenance of X inactivation in eutherians, and that's certainly something I'd be keen to get your input on. But in rounding up this study, I think the take-home message that we have derived from this study is that actually DNA demethylation may be particularly important for formation of the placenta, and I would advocate the view that actually the wiping that takes place likely preceded the divergence of marsupials and eutherians. Now, of course, we need to look at more marsupials, and we know from work in eutherians that X inactivation occurs in many different ways. So, of course, we're basing our evidence on one marsupial species. But I do think that perhaps this evolved primarily to set aside the trophectoderm, and I'm very happy to say why I think that's important. Okay, so I'm going to wind up, and I hopefully have time for just one more slide after this slide, because I want to tell you about something else that we're very excited about in the lab. But I really want to just summarize by saying that X dosage compensation, of course, is a problem that lots of species face. But they can solve it in many, many different ways. And I should say that I think we're really blessed as people working on dosage compensation because every species we study does things in a slightly different way. And I think that's great because it keeps us all interested and is quite provocative. And that marsupials, I think, are still a hugely underused model organism. We've studied them to study non-coding RNA biology, X inactivation, and imprinting. But I'm hoping that if we can develop genome editing technologies to make them more efficient, that maybe more scientists will begin to use this fantastic model organism. And a huge aspiration of mine actually is to move from X inactivation to study another field that may or may not get mentioned at this conference, which is sex determination, because it turns out actually that sex determination in marsupials is X dosage dependent, and I think this will be particularly interesting to this audience. And so in my final slide, I just will give you a sort of brief overview of how sex determination is achieved in eutherians, because it ultimately comes down to the presence or absence of the Y chromosome. So in essence, you have the Y, which harbors SRY, the testis-determining gene. And if you have SRY, you will develop a testis. And if you don't have SRY, supported by other developmental programs, you will form an ovary. But actually, secondary sexual determination, the other features, most of them external, they will develop in response to the gonadal hormones that are created in response to the ultimate genetic decision that's imposed by the Y chromosome. Now, in marsupials, things are different because while the primary sex determination signal, the testis or ovary, is determined by the presence or absence of the Y chromosome, the secondary sexual characteristics are determined by the number of X chromosomes. So, irrespective of your Y chromosome status, if you have two Xs, you will develop in marsupials the mammary pattern of the female pattern of mammary glands and you'll develop a pouch. And if you have one X chromosome, irrespective of your Y chromosome complement, you'll develop a gubernaculum and a scrotum. So this is fascinating to us. And it means that there must be a gene that escapes X inactivation that's regulating sex determination. And this was originally discovered by the lab of Marilyn Renfrey, who's one of my great scientific heroes. And actually, this phenomenon was identified exclusively by studying the development and anatomy of the Tamil wallaby. And she called this the pouch mammary scrotum gene. So maybe 5 or 10 years from now, we would have identified this gene and taken the lab in a new direction. Okay, so that's where I'm going to finish. Thank you very much for hearing my talk today. I want to thank everyone in the lab. I've mentioned a number of names earlier on, but really we work on a whole bunch of different diverse topics related to sex chromosome biology in the lab, and everybody is very collaborative and contributes to everyone's projects. And I mentioned on the right-hand side a number of very important people who've given us advice and reagents that have contributed to the work that I've talked about today. And of course, all the funders and CRIC-Core facilities for helping us make these important discoveries. Thank you for your time.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.